Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at BollAndBranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
My podcasts often deal with distressing situations which are not suitable for children and some adults, for that matter. Some of what I discuss may trigger uncomfortable emotions. If that does occur, please reach out to Lifeline, Beyond Blue, or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Please keep in mind that there's always two sides, sometimes more, to every story. My guests provide their recollection of an event or incident, sharing their thoughts and their emotions, but it's theirs. Not everybody will agree with them. I never want to tell any guest what to say or what not to say, so there will always be others that see it differently, and I understand that. Hello, I'm Narelle Fraser. I was a cop with Victoria Police for 27 years, 15 of those as a detective, having dealt with all types of crime, from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. I witnessed the effect crime has on those involved and became one of those victims myself in 2012 when I was diagnosed with PTSD. However, out of adversity comes other opportunities like this, my own podcast. I'm still pinching myself. Thanks for listening and coming with me as we explore the human side and impact of crime.
So I'm on my back with the firearm, grappling with them. They wanted it. I'm struggling with them, and one of the offenders actually pointed a barrel at my face, and I put my thumb between the trigger and the guard, and he's trying to pull the trigger.
You could never accuse my guest today of sitting idly after being medically retired from New South Wales Police after a distinguished career spanning 26 years, which included doing time at homicide and arson. But her passion, like me, was sexual assaults, to the point she became an instructor in sexual assault investigating. But her career, her police career, was just one of Judy Palmer's many skills, or some may know her by her then married name of Judy Keegan. Since her forced retirement, Judy has been a real estate agent. She's part of a group called Singing Hands, which is a choir for the deaf. She's a driving instructor with NRMA, a Thermomix consultant. She's heavily involved in her local pony club and happens to ride a Harley Davidson soft tail heritage motorcycle as a member of the Ulysses motorcycle branch in Woi Woi, New South Wales. She's currently the president of the Ladies of Harley, Central Coast Harley Owners Group. HOG, love that. If that's not one of the widest varieties of interests one has in this life, I will go he. I wonder which one gives her or gave her the most satisfaction, and I'm guessing Judy likes people. Yeah, I know I'm taking a punt, but, you know, I think I might be right. There is so much in her busy life that I'd love to chat to Judy about, but initially I'm going to be speaking to Judy about her policing career, what she loved, a few investigations she was involved with, and I'm assuming there's some that she will never, ever be able to forget. And then being medically retired, due to, quote, work-related injuries, unquote. Anyway, we're going to find out about that and more. So welcome, Judy, and I'm actually quite surprised that you found time in your busy life to put aside an hour or so for us here at NFI. But thanks for your time.
Pleasure, Nora. Lovely to be here.
Likewise. It's lovely to have you. So you're in New South Wales. You would have had, today's your first day of freedom.
Yes, Narelle, 11th of October, Freedom Day, when us fully vaccinated can get out and start enjoying all the few things we've missed. And in particular, I went for a coffee with a girlfriend this morning, and I don't mind telling you just how enjoyable that was. Very much missed.
Oh, look, I can't imagine, Judy. I have a sister in Metro Melbourne, and she is... just struggling is a bit harsh, but she just misses just going out with her girlfriends, seeing us, you know, her sisters, and just those little things that we used to take for granted, just going in and having a quick cuppa like you have today. It must be so nice.
It was.
Yeah. Now, Judy, through us chatting before today, we found out that we'd both been to business college as young women, and we'd both attained similar speeds with our typing, but it's your Pitman shorthand speed which enabled you to become a court reporter, and that's what I couldn't attain. I got to think about 108 words a minute, but it wasn't 110, which I needed to be a court reporter. So can you tell us about being a court reporter? Because that's what happened. You were able to attain that, was it 110 words a minute?
It was actually 120.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, words per minute. But look, after school, all those years ago, women went into hairdressing or secretary work. So I went to business college and learned all the finer skills of typing and dear old Pitman shorthand, which was such a skill in those days, but sadly it's not today. But I found it very useful in my policing career. So, I went to business college and did well, and I actually did become a court reporter in the Supreme Court. Look, only for a few weeks. It was very stressful, taking down verbatim what judges and barristers alike had to say. And you'd only do 10 or 15 minutes, and then the judge would say, "Excuse me, stop talking. We have a change of court reporter," and someone else would come in, and we'd go back and transcribe it straight away, typing it. So, I was only there a little while. I just wasn't my thing to do day in, day out. But I've always found courts very interesting, and I think that's where I fell in love with the law and courts and the whole process of justice.
I'm not sure why. I think I wanted to be a court reporter because for some reason I thought courts were an exciting place and interesting, just such a mixture. And that was well before I ever thought of being a policewoman. Like, this is when I was about 16. But to actually get 120 words a minute, that is fast. That's impressive.
Yeah, it was great. Do you remember how our notebooks were divided in half, the line down the middle, so that you were quicker to come back to the starting point on the left than going right across? It reduced, you know, all these lovely technicalities, but I can assure you it was the greatest skill, that with typing in the police force, for recording things I ever had, and it was a great, great skill.
And, you know, I'm sure that you would use it as much as I do. I still use it. And I always remember as when I first joined, it was everybody – well, I was going to say everybody knew the lady that did the shorthand.
Yes.
I don't mean everybody, but it was a skill that people would say, "Oh, are you the one that does that shorthand?"
Yeah, that shorthand.
Hey, I remember one time giving evidence in court, and I don't know about you, but I used to, as a police person, you dread court and you dread having to get up in the witness box and, you know, give your notes and, you know, talk and tell them what's happened.
Cross-examined.
Oh, cross-examination. However, I think you must have been like me a bit, because I used to just wait for them to say... Do you have your notes there, Constable?
Yes, Constable.
And I used to wait and I'd say, yes, I have. And they'd, could I have them, please? You know, and they're all very uppity. And I'd give them my notes and you could see the blood run out of their faces, you know, the defence or whatever. Did you have that?
Just loved it. And, of course, you know, like yourself, oh, yes, Mr. So-and-so, I have my notebook here. Oh, yes, can I see it, Miss Constable? No, you're referring, you know. And the blood would drain from their face, like you say. And then I'd have a couple of barristers challenge me and he goes, read me that evidence, and I would just read it. And then he'd look at it again and he goes, read it again. And and then he would realise that I was proficient in Pittman's shorthand. And it was a really great skill because you got so many admissions of little things that really, I think, made it a watertight case when it came to giving evidence that I liked. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember one time a judge said to me in a trial and they asked for my notes, so I gave them. And the judge said to me, "And what sort of shorthand is this, senior?" I had the joy of saying to him, "Well, Pittman, Your Honour." And apparently, the way I said it, it was like, "You bloody idiot! Don't you know anything about shorthand?" You know, it was Pittman, Your Honour. Like, was there ever anything else?
he should have known. But there was another type of shorthand, from what I remember.
Yeah, there was,
but it wasn't as used as much. And Pittman was the shorthand to use, and I still use it. I still write notes in it in my head. Yeah. It's a skill you never ever lose. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and I used it until virtually the very last day of my career. Like, I've still got notebooks, you know, with all the shorthand in it, and I can still read
it.
It's amazing. Mm. It's amazing. Mm. So, Judy, why did you become a policewoman? Tell us about that.
Well, I had first-hand experience in seeing police officers. My father was a high-ranking superintendent, John Palmer, in charge of the CIB, and my brother was a uniformed officer, you know, in the inner western suburbs. And I saw the pride that they came home with after a hard day's work, but making a difference to people's lives, helping victims, bringing people to justice, the feeling of worth of doing a job well done. And I looked at it and remember, this is 1981 when I joined and I was 21 and I said to my father, "Dad, I'd like to join the police force." And he said, "Oh, geez, it's a man's world." He said, "I wish you the best," he said, "but promise me one thing." He said, "Don't ever lose your femininity." And I said, "No, Dad, I won't." And I really, I think, took that on board, not to become one of the boys and swear and curse and drink like a sailor. And I think I held my head high in that regard, and that was good advice.
Mm. You know, you say that about not losing your femininity. Mm. I don't think I consciously felt like that, but I know that I always wanted to look nice, I suppose.
Yes.
Like I would always put on, I mean, I don't wear a lot of makeup, but I think I always would probably put on some foundation, and I always, no matter what happened, I would always have on lipstick. Isn't that like, I couldn't go anywhere without lipstick. I never have and I never will.
Narelle, I'm exactly the same. And I think Dad just didn't want to see me turn in and lose that lovely feminineness. But I'll just digress. I did a job with my partner and it was a raid we had to go to, and the TRG were there and the television cameras were there as well. So my partner's putting on a bulletproof vest and I'm putting on my lipstick. And he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "The cameras are there." He said, "Oh, of course."
Oh, I love it.
Oh, yeah,
you know, and you say about your femininity and that you know, that you couldn't, you didn't want to drink like them or swear or whatever it was you said, but, oh, dear, I've learned to swear terribly. Oh,
yes.
The F-bomb comes out far too much in my vocabulary.
Me too. Only the wrong moment.
Yeah, yeah. So can you give us a snapshot of your 26-year career with New South Wales Police?
Gosh, how long have you got? I joined as a young constable at 21. I did 5 years in uniform, and I passed out from the Redfern Police Academy in a skirt, stockings, shoes, and they gave you a handbag for your gun, your handcuffs, and a towel that had police written on it in case someone should vomit on you or you needed to wipe your hands or something. So let me assure you, the towel went, the handbag went. I wrapped my gun and my handcuffs in one of the fellow officers' belts, and off I went doing all of that. But it was really difficult in this stupid skirt. So I was the very first policewoman in New South Wales to wear the culottes that you may or may not see on some female officers now. And I got in the newspaper. It was a big event, you know, an officer and a lady and wearing culottes. And after 5 years, I soon tired of accidents, domestics and death messages. I felt I had more to give as a person to my community. And I really loved the thrill of the chase. So I decided to go into criminal investigation, where I started out, and I went to an eastern suburbs detective's office as a brand new, you know, plainclothes officer. And when I arrived, they said, "Oh, hello, Jude. Have you got a duty book?" And I said, "What's a duty book?" That's how much I knew, which is a duty book is something that police used to record all their daily events in, who they spoke to, where they went. And it was quite an official record. I'm sure it's all computerized now. So I was on a big learning curve, but I was always told that you have two ears and one mouth, so hear twice as much as you say. I took that in mind, knew my place, learnt a lot, and grew from there.
Mm. You know, you talk, I think we might have to explain that to our listeners, when you talked about passing out in your skirt and your handbag. Passing out is not, although you can faint from the pressure, can't you?
Of the day.
Of the day, that's right. But you might just explain what passing out is.
So sorry, Narelle. Our passing out parade in the New South Wales Police Force is held at the Academy. It used to be at Redfern, where I passed out from. It's now in Goulburn, of course. And it's the culmination of all your training, of which was 12 weeks at the time, can you believe it? And we're having passed all academic and physical tests. You are at the Academy, and you actually swear in front of the Commissioner and dignitaries. You give an oath to, protect the community, your fellow officer, on the Bible, and you take the oath. And that's a very moving moment, and we all throw our caps in the air. And our first station is given to us, and off we go Monday. Yeah, walk in the front door. My first station was Chatswood. I had my hat and my uniform on, and that was the last day I went through the front door. I went through the back from there. That was a bit of a thrill.
I thought you were going to say it was the last day you ever wore a hat, because you
those hats. I lost mine once in the station, and the boys filled it up with water, tipped it upside down and put it in the freezer. So when I found it 3 hours later and put it on my head, I was all saturated.
You know, I've spoken to many people about the handbag. Like, really, what a ridiculous piece of equipment was a handbag. It was the worst. It was a real granny type of handbag. And it wasn't leather. It was some
vinyl
crap. Oh, yes. But the towel, I've never heard. We didn't get a towel.
Yes, it was about, 30 centimetres square, and it was cream, and it had police in blue writing.
So, without being rude, where did you put the towel?
Well, that was supposed to go in the handbag with your gun and your handcuffs.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so
seriously?
I know.
We've come a long way, haven't we?
I can't find my lipstick as if I can find my gun in a handbag. Like, come on.
I reckon you might be able to find a gun in a handbag. So what are some of the more memorable moments that you remember attending or being involved in those early years?
Well, look, in the early years in uniform, especially in this straight skirt and this very impracticable skirt and top, I was on the truck with a sergeant, big guy, and the truck was the main car. When you're at a police station, you have like a head car or truck, and it's usually like the paddy wagon. wagon. We had big, you know, F-250s that were massive. And so we had come across a motorbike that was stolen. So, of course, you do a check, you know, radio, can I have a check on this number plate? And, yes, it's stolen. So off we go chasing this motorbike, and he goes to a dead end at Artarmon, and he flies off, and he jumps and runs through the bushes, which was at the back of Artarmon Bowling Club. So the sergeant says to me, off you go, you know, junior constable, right? Up goes the skirt, round my hips, over the fence, and I'm chasing this guy. And this big motorbike rider, he was a big guy with a helmet on, and he's running, and I'm chasing him through the bush. And all the people at the Artarmon Bowling Club could see the commotion down the hill. So I'm chasing him, but I'm losing him. He's you know, the gap between us is getting bigger. And I went, I've got to get this guy. How can I get him? So I didn't take out my gun. I just said, stop, police, or I'll shoot. And he stopped, put his hands up in the air and said, I give up. And I ran up, handcuffed him, marched him back. All the people in the bowling club were clapping, and back to my, you know, very big senior. And he went, oh my God. And I thought, how good am I? But I really just went, stop or I'll shoot. And he stopped.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
You would have been a bit of a legend.
Well,
having done that.
Oh, yes. Geez, Jude chases all the crooks down, but and he was a big guy with a helmet on. I went, God, am I gonna tackle him or catch him? But it was very funny. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. So is there some sort of an incident or investigation that stayed with you, and why?
Yeah, and why? Particularly as a detective, I have a couple. One was just an incredibly violent situation where an offender was drunk coming home from the pub one night. He broke into a car, found a replica pistol under the seat. And this, to me, is a lesson is why we have laws as to why we cannot have replica pistols. So replica means it's unable to be fired. It looks like a firearm, but it can't be fired or discharged. So this particular offender got this pistol. He then saw a ground floor house. It was summer. He climbed in. He held the gun at the husband, belted him up, locked him in the bathroom, and then proceeded to pick up their six-month-old child, hold the gun to their head, and said to the mother and the wife, right, do my bidding, which sadly compiled of being fed alcohol and raping her on and on and on for many, many hours. The offender eventually fell drunkenly asleep on the lounge, naked with the gun in his hand. They very bravely crept out the window. And we got a call about 11 o'clock at night saying that there was, and they were visiting from overseas, they were an Irish couple, and they had run to the only person they had known about 10 kilometres away and raised the alarm. No mobile phones in those days. So we got a report that there was a very dishevelled couple with a baby, unharmed but beside themselves, and that the offender was asleep in their unit. So we call TRG, and that's like our riot squad that go in armed, secure the offender, and then we came in. We interviewed that offender, and he knew that the firearm was a replica, but the husband or the man that was beaten up and held at gunpoint so that his wife could be raped didn't. And when we actually told him that it was a replica pistol, he just went to pieces because, yeah, he wasn't there to protect his wife and baby. So I was very proud of that job. I worked very hard. At trial, the witnesses gave wonderful evidence. It was a very traumatic. They'd actually gone back to Ireland by then. So we got them back. They gave evidence. And we got the fellow, I think, about 9 years imprisonment. So we got up on all 18 charges, which means he was convicted on all 18 offences. And then our DPP, our legal body that prosecute our matters at trial, appealed, which is unusual, and we actually got him about 12 or 13 years. So it sticks with me because of the violent nature, the fact that all offences were proven, and he spent a long time in jail. Yeah, that's just one of them. There's another one where I was the one being the victim, but that's another story. But if you'd like to hear it, let me know.
I'm letting you know.
Thank you.
If you feel you can tell it, I'd love to know.
Absolutely. This event is actually one that changed my thinking and how real policing is every day. You can go to work, 1 minute you're doing a shoplifter, the next minute you're investigating a murder or you're arresting someone at gunpoint. But there was some gentlemen at this particular detective's office that I was off, some offenders, and we had a firearms amnesty. And what a firearms amnesty is, it's something the government bring in every so often to actually get illegal firearms off the street, and people are free of prosecution. So that if they've got an illegal firearm or don't have a license or they got it by unlawful means, they can surrender it and we get it off the streets. And I think it's a great idea. So we received information that these people had some shotguns, and we did a search warrant. Now, I went with three fellow detectives, and they said, oh, sorry, Jude, we've only got three bulletproof vests. Funny about that. So, you know, in that day and age, apparently female detectives were a little bit dispensable. So I went with one of the detectives to the back door. The other two detectives went in the front door, and the only person home was a lady who didn't speak English, an older lady. And so we're saying, call your sons to the house. You know, they're their guns. So we're out the back, and I'd actually said to my offsider, I said, look, I want to get this firearm out of here that we've seized. Give me the car keys and I'll take it to the police car while we're waiting for the owners to arrive. Well, as I'm walking down the side of the house, the two brothers drive down the drive at full speed, get out and jump me. So I'm on my back with the firearm, shotgun, grappling with them. They wanted it. Now, whenever we seize a firearm, as you would know, it's operational procedure to check if the firearm is loaded or not or safe.
Correct.
Now, yep. I hadn't been told that by my offsider or if he'd done it. So as you would know, Narelle, every firearm is considered loaded until you know otherwise.
Yep.
So
yep.
These two are jumping on me and I'm struggling with them, and one of the offenders actually raised it, pointed it at my face, the barrel at my face, and I put my thumb behind the trigger, between the trigger and the guard, and he's trying to pull the trigger to discharge firearm. Now, I didn't know if it was loaded, but let me tell you, it wasn't long before I had three big detectives on top of these two offenders, and they were removed. And yeah, so I then dusted off, I think I had a white skirt on that day, dusted off the skirt and my stockings and popped it in the back of the car seat and gave thanks that I was lucky to think ahead and put my, so you go to instinct mode, but it just goes to show how quickly it can change. They actually got a barrister and went to court. We all gave evidence and they were acquitted. Yeah, so and I actually went home. I was married at the time and I made arrangements to make my will because that was a bit close for comfort, that one.
Boy.
Yeah.
So how did they win? How did they get acquitted?
It was an amnesty, and it was some technicality or something. We all had to give evidence and what have you, and you know these things happen. So it was only one offence. So under the amnesty, perhaps they were given, the right of acquittal. But that's okay.
So something like that, how did you – you said, you know, you brushed yourself off and went back to work virtually. How did that job affect you emotionally? Did you speak to anybody? Did you think, I can't because what are they going to say? No.
And I'd like to think that in this day, I hope it is, that there's far more psychological support, briefings, acknowledgements. So I'd like to think today there might be a senior officer that might say, hey, Jude, you've had an incident. How about you go and speak to someone? But police, you know, we've got to have this big facade of bravery. Oh, I'm all right. We prefer to debrief over a beer at the pub, as you know, Narelle. So, that's what we would do and have a laugh about it and dismiss it. But it hasn't stuck with me as much as other things. Later on, there were some cases that certainly affected me. But funnily enough, I was married, single, no children, and I just went, And it just heightened my awareness of every job. I've locked up shoplifters that have given me more hard times physically than locking up people for murder or armed hold-up or violent offences. So the actions of the offender certainly do not match the offence, if that makes sense.
Mm. You just said then that you dismissed it, or you think you have.
Mm.
But I'm wondering, in reality, how you could dismiss something where really your life could have ended right there and then on that day.
Yep, and I thought it was. Being younger, I think, and in the beginning, I think you deal with it a lot better, because I personally feel that police work just steps up. Gets bigger, better, if and how they don't affect you. So I was about 29 at the time, and really excited to be a detective and doing my job. And I think I just dismissed it as, look, this is part and parcel. But I was certainly far more heightened with every single matter I attended or person I came in contact with. Yeah.
Mm, I bet you were. Yeah. And, you know, the thing, please don't get me wrong, like the firearm in your face, you putting your thumb in between so it doesn't fire. But you know what really riles me about that job is the fact that there's three vests.
Yeah,
and
me
it's
too.
And it's just assumed that Judy
woman.
Why would Judy need a vest?
Oh, she's a woman. Oh, I'm going to pretend. Yeah, that was it. And I don't know if that was done deliberately. Years ago in general CI, like your stations of detectives, bulletproof vests were very rare. You know, to get one was pretty difficult. So that was just, oh, okay, they're hard to get, but, oh, yeah, you're at the end of the – I drew the short straw. I'm dispensable. And that's the way I felt. I felt dispensable and yeah, just one of the many biased gender incidents.
Well, you and I could spend the next hour a couple of hours talking about the issues with gender and with how we were treated as females in that male-dominated world. However, I've also got to say, and I'm sure you would too, that I worked with some of the best policemen, best men I had the pleasure of working with. There were just some fantastic policemen.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
But it's those ones that treat you like, well, they, you know, look, you don't have the vest duty, you don't matter. Did you have the same experience with policemen? Like, did you?
Oh, I was so proud to work with the finest that I would just look at them in awe, particularly our homicide detectives. I met the most beautiful gentlemen doing murders and investigations that I was just in awe of. And there was one in particular, and they've said, Jude, just sitting on an interview with him, with this particular detective sergeant, you'll learn so much. And he was an absolute gentleman. He was never raised his voice, but smart, and he always got what he wanted, which was, and I learned a lot from that as an investigator. And I've actually had another fellow officer do a podcast who said that when she came to the station I last finished at, she said, and I got teamed up with the most wonderful, outstanding investigative detective I can name. And she was talking about me, and I was really proud. Yeah, that was one of my better skills, my people skills.
Wow. Because I can remember working when I was at the homicide squad, I used to watch in awe. Ron Eddles. I don't know if you've heard of Ron.
He's on the TV now, Narelle.
Yes, he is. He's got it. He's on Sunday nights, I think it is. But that's just one thing. He's on. Ron is like Ron everywhere at the moment. but I watched an interview with Ron Eddles one time, and you're right. You learn so much. And Ron, I don't think I've ever heard Ron raise his voice, and I've worked with him a fair bit. But I've never heard him raise his voice. He never raised a hand. He never threatened.
Nope.
All he did was listen, talk really softly. And I'll never forget an interview I saw Ron do with a man that had abducted and killed a little boy out near our Tullamarine Airport. And the offender was, I think he was an Indian man, and that's neither here nor there, but Ron interviewing him, and this man, he'd panicked. And look, the bottom line is Ron actually, I'll never forget it, in the interview, the man was so affected, I suppose, by Ron. Like, Ron was just being so nice and kind. And the man, I think he tried to hold Ron's hand or something like that. And Ron didn't flinch. It just went along. Anyway, Ron ended up actually kneeling beside him, and the man was just beside himself crying into Ron's shoulder. I have never forgotten it. And, you know, that caused a lot of differing opinions within Victoria Police. People had said that's ridiculous, like fancy letting somebody in. They just thought that was way over the top. I thought it was one of the most powerful interviews I've ever seen, ever.
And I really believe that most police are very empathic. We really do have a lot of empathy for our victims and our offenders. And I'm really proud to say that my father, a superintendent detective, he was in the homicide squad for years too. And, you know, he would get a Christmas card here and there from offenders who would always say, to dear detective, you know, gentleman Palmer, that, you know, because he was the same. He had a job to do, professional. And I feel that when people yell and scream, or officers do, they're out of control, and they're not showing the professionalism that's required. But that's a very moving story, Narelle. And I used to use that tactic. Not tactic, but I used to use that gentle way with pedophiles in particular. And I found that it just made them relax, and they would tell you what you wanted to hear.
They would. Yeah. And I found that too, Jude. And I found that even though inside what they had done was so repulsive, But if we showed them that we were repulsed, they were or disgusted, they're not going to tell us anything. And so I used to, and I wouldn't say I acted at all. I was actually really interested. Oh, I don't know if that sounds right, but I was interested in the psychology behind why they did what they did and how they felt and where did this come from. And like you, I think they felt comfortable. And who else is a pedophile going to tell this terrible crime to? They're going to tell it to somebody who they think is interested.
That's right. And I think that feeds part of that psychology as well. Whereas they expect you to come in banging desks and throwing books and things. Oh, no. And it completely puts them off guard when you're professional and empathic and you listen and they keep talking and we keep writing and then we go to court and convict them. That's when I feel the satisfaction when they are convicted. I don't care how I act in an interview room, so long as I act within the law and I convict them, that to me is my reward.
Mm. I tell you what isn't our reward, though, is when we do take them to court and they get, like the offenders that you were talking about, where they get acquitted or we can't get past committal. I used to feel a terrible failure when I couldn't get the evidence over the line or we couldn't get it past committal. Oh, that feeling of, yeah, failure. These people, the victim and their families, they look at you at you know, for strength, for support. Mm. You say, look, we've got a good case, and you try and say, look, you know, anything could happen here, and you think you've got a great case, and then you lose. Oh, it is.
It's funny you should mention that, Narelle, because I did have a very high conviction rate because I believed in doing the job properly. I'm not going to do it half-hearted. And there were offenders, I would say, that I'd say, listen, mate, I know you've done it. I'm not going to charge you today, but keep looking over your shoulder because when I get the evidence, you'll be charged. And I would wait until I could. But one of the last cases I did up here on the coast was a particularly violent domestic violence where the ex-husband had actually planned to come in with a shotgun, shoot the wife and take away their four children. The wife had been smart enough to actually put them on a plane to another state. He turned up. There was a fight with the ex-husband. He had a shotgun and the boyfriend was a martial arts expert and she gave him a knife and there was a melee and off the offender ran with stab wounds in his back and in the melee. So he went up the road and said he accidentally fell off his bike and a very nice neighbour was looking after him. And I sent the car up there and I said, don't let him move. To cut a long story short, a very difficult case, but everyone was okay. Went to trial, three-week trial. He had a barrister that actually summed up, which means he summed up his side of the case for 3 days. He spoke for 3 days. And I had lovely witnesses. They were very upfront, nothing to hide. And he was acquitted. And it actually started to erode my belief in the justice system. I felt for my victims. I felt a failure. And I was really struggling with leaving a young family. I had young family then for 3 weeks. And it was all just a bit too much. But that feeling of failure is very real, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's nothing that can make you feel any better for a while because you've put your heart and soul into this job, and then basically the court is saying you're not good enough, really.
Yes, the jury. Jurors are reticent to convict, but I'm glad it's a 12 of them must agree.
I bet you don't miss the call-outs, the on-calls.
And being a woman, a female detective, pretty rare in those days. All the sexual assaults or anything to do with children, and I was an hour away a lot of the times, and they'd ring up, and I'd say, right, keep everybody there for an hour, and I'd fly down the freeway and sort it out. But I'm really proud with the ones that I did. I'd often get flowers from my sexual assault victims or a thank you card, and I still have those cards, Narelle.
Yeah, I do too.
Yep. Absolutely. Showing those victims, you know, it's okay, and getting them help and support, and yeah, it makes a big difference.
The call outs and on calls, it causes such a disruption, doesn't it, to our social life, ours, theirs, your. I still say us. I can't get. I've been away from 6 or 7 years, and I still consider myself one of them, isn't it?
Yes.
Funny, but it does. It affects so many aspects of your life. Oh,
it does. I remember working Christmas after Christmas, or you'd book holidays and they'd say, all leave's cancelled, there's a job on or something. You know, kids' birthdays, things like that, that people don't realise that, that's it. We're 24/7. We're up in 24/7. So
yeah, you're right.
If something happens, yeah, you call down. And you don't want to miss gathering evidence and presenting it in its best light. You can't be half-hearted about any job in the police. It must be done 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember a call out one time when I was working at a station and I was one up, meaning that, you know, that was it. I was the only person on call. And, you know, to go out of a night in a divisional van on your own, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, going to, say, a pub brawl, or going to somebody's been assaulted, or there's somebody outside their window, a prowler or whatever, like that's tough stuff. And I can remember one night being called out, and I was half an hour away from where the station was, and I got home at, say, I don't know, 11:30, and I was called out at about 1. So I drive in, do my stuff, get home, and I'm exhausted, and it's about 3 o'clock when I get home, and I'm in bed probably 10 minutes and the phone went again. Bottom line is I got called out 4 times in the one night, and I was on for the weekend on my own because there's no one else. Like that sort of stuff, that is, I don't know if they can do that anymore. I think they've realised that there's a lot of psychological damage and a lot of stress. Who would have thought, with policing, and that you can't do those hours anymore. It's got to be a good thing, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And Narelle, I refer to your call out. Not once did, I know you wouldn't have, or did I, whinge or complain. You just went and did it because our belief in protection of people is stronger than our own needs, and the protection of the community, and that justice must be served. It's really, really powerful. And I think that's part of the appeal for people joining the police, is that we need to serve, and we serve our community without, you know, fear or favour, and we all very, very brave, get up, do it, dark or not, whether you got a sore head or a, you know, whatever, you just get on and do it. And that's the commitment that our officers do, and I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, you're right. And I can remember the last call out, it was like, you're kidding me, aren't you? Like, and D24 was saying, I'm sorry, I know, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you're right. I had the last call out was a young 7-year-old. Who there was allegations that he'd been raped. And I can remember I worked all day. I didn't get home, and I don't know, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was on call that night as well. And I thought, if I get called out tonight, you're right. You do it because you love it. You do it because you want to help people. That's why we join, isn't it?
Absolutely. And our personal needs go to the back of the line. We have a job to do, and it's got to be done. And people say, well, you know, how do you deal with being in the police? Well, I'm a professional. A job's got to be done. So you just do it. You don't think about it. But it certainly takes its toll year after year, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And so, Judy, working in a male-dominated world, as it was in our day, you experienced some difficulties, didn't you, some issues with sexual harassment and maybe some bullying. Can you and being a mum?
Yes.
Can you tell us about some of those difficulties?
Absolutely. I always say that some of my biggest battles were fought within the walls of the police station as opposed to outside. There was just one particular police detective's office in particular that I don't know if it was a closed shop or a boys' club, I suspect. They just did not want a female detective in their office. They were very busy socially and extramarital ways, and I think that they felt threatened, but all I wanted to do was get my head down, be a good detective. My offsider, who I was teamed up with, was a lovely family man, and he taught me so much and we got on so well, and we had a little bit of a us and them mentality against those doing that, but they took great pride in just annoying me with doing things around my desk and the phone and all of that. And as you say, one of those was going to that job with the firearms. Oh, there's only three bulletproof vests, just things like the things in your pigeonhole, which is for those that it's a little shelf where they put your paperwork, you know, for each officer. So, you know, you get things in there. But it did go on, and I would go to the person doing it and I'd say, look, can you just give it a break? I just want to do my job. But no, it continued on by quite a few of them. So I went to my boss and he said, well, Judy, if you don't like the heat in the kitchen, get out of the office. So that was the response. I didn't want to take it further. There were no laws in place to protect women in the police force. You just to put up with it and try and do your job. So, it was difficult. And then I was one of the first female detectives to go part-time because I'd had my daughter and they didn't know how to deal with part-time detectives. Oh, my God, what are we going to do? So I was instrumental in getting that up and running, and I actually applied for a job share partner, which caused a lot of ruckus. You can't job share a detective. And I said, well, yes, we can. So I was assigned another lady officer and we shared jobs, and I'd do it. She was inexperienced, so I would write out what to do on this case, go and interview this person, go and gather this evidence, go and do this, and she'd do that, and then I'd do the arrest. And she grew and learnt a lot like that. It actually worked really quite well. Call-outs were difficult. My husband at the time was not in the police, but he was supportive of me trying to do that. But, it went on for many years at this particular station and was never really a problem any other station. So I just feel it was akin to that macho chest beating type, which I'd like to think is far less these days, and that women can work on an equal footing with men as we should.
Yeah, we could. There's a lot of issues. You know, I can remember having a camera put up in the days when we used to wear skirts. I can remember, you know, a camera being put up my skirt and a photo taken. And to the point where you could actually see my cotton gusset from my pantyhose, like humiliating stuff. And, you know, to then go up on the board for everyone to see all sorts of stuff like that, you know, watching pornos, you know, at dinner time. And anyway, look, as you say, it was a different world back then, but I don't know about you, but I couldn't go to anybody because they were all in it together. I mean, I was the only, one of very few females. But anyway, look, New South Wales have had its fair share of issues with corruption over the years, but I know you're not the Lone Ranger there. Victoria's issues would take years of podcasts to cover, and I won't be touching it with a 10-foot pole, don't worry about that. But I would like to talk to you about the culture in New South Wales police, which, like anywhere else at the time, was marred by cynicism, pessimism, glorification of alcohol, permitted sexism, the list goes on. But you never saw any corruption, I think you told me, but you did find out years later that it had been going on virtually under your nose. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I refer to those powerful words, Neryl, cynicism, pessimism, glorification of alcohol, permitted sexism. I saw all of it. Absolutely. But in regards to corruption, I suppose I sent out a vibe very early that I won't see or be part of any corruption, and it's not necessary to do your job well, and we need to hold our heads high and be professional. But now, looking back, I think my father being a detective superintendent might have had some influence on if anything was going on, it was not going to be in front of me. So I think that was another reason why at this other detective's office I was not welcomed with open arms, even though I was a very hard worker and did everything by the book. And the boss loved me because we got such a great arrest and conviction rate. But the other fellows liked to, you know, come in still drunk overnight and sleep in the corner and things like that. So if that's corruption, I might have witnessed that. Under ICAC, I actually went for a job with ICAC, an interview, and having read the statute law of the ICAC role, corruption is defined as if you go and have a haircut during your lunch hour, if you go to the post office and pay your gas bill, I'm guilty. During work hours, I'm guilty. So that corruption, I think, you know, but regards to taking money or bashing or planting drugs, never, ever saw any of it. But it was when I left that I realised at this other detective's office where I was sexually discriminated and bullied, they were actually selling information off our police system about cars and vehicles and things to whoever knows what. But they were getting cash in hand for it. But I only found out about it years later, and that is the only level of corruption I knew about. And if I did, I would have done something about it because there were, isn't this ironic, Narelle, there were laws in place to protect and prosecute those guilty of corruption. But for us being sexually discriminated and assaulted, there was no laws. How ironic.
It is, isn't it?
Again, yeah. Women were dispensable. Yeah. That's the message I got.
Oh, Judy, 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 Judy. Do you ever get that? What was that song? Judy, Judy, Judy,
do you love me?
Judy, 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 do you care? Your career was cut short on medical grounds. So was it due to one particular reason or an accumulation or can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, my physical work-related injury was physical. We were actually doing training. Each year you have to be ticked off as proficient in physical bomb checking, searches, unarmed combat, things like that. So we had our TRG along and I was a detective, you know, in the suit and the heels and the stockings and my offsider was away on leave. So I got paired with a lovely young zealous young constable and we were doing arm bar sweeps and I did a few on him where you grab the arm and you use your foot to sweep their leg out and bring them down. Well, lovely young constable was very zealous and did that with me, but he more like spear tackled me into the ground and I got a neck injury. And that sort of just came to haunt me over the years. And then, of course, the psychological was cumulative but was actually when I went to a baby, I actually had my daughter and I came back after 12 months leave without pay. I had severe postnatal depression, which my bosses knew about, and I hadn't been back long and they sent me to a very violent baby murder. And I think you know what that involves. It was a terrible family, very poor, very drug affected. The children were neglected terribly. And, of course, with that, you know, you get post-mortem, you've got to go to all of that. So myself and another lady detective did that case and that was sort of the beginning of the undoing for me, sadly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've said many times that I can I could handle most things in policing, but anything to do with children, and I think there's not many that aren't affected by investigations and jobs you get with neglected, abused, assaulted children that have died.
Because it's all preventable.
Well, yes.
That's what I say. It need not have happened.
Yeah. Look, Judy, unfortunately, we're a bit pressed for time today, but I did want to ask you a couple of things. I could talk to you about policing for the rest of, you know, the rest of the night. But could you tell us just a little bit about your motorbike? And please keep in mind that I know nothing about them. So if I don't fall off my chair when you tell me, for instance, the make and model, the CCs, the KGs, which would impress many, including my husband, Please don't be offended. Tell us about your motorbike.
I won't be offended at all, Noel. When I left the police force, I went, oh, what am I going to do with myself? So I went and, as you know, did real estate and what have you. And my dear friend Monica said to me, how about we plan a trip to Italy and we go and ride a Vespa in Italy? And I went, I'm not riding a motorbike or a scooter. Don't be stupid. And she said, how about we get our license here? And I said, oh, all right. So I got myself a 150cc scooter, high powered as it is, fell off it, cried, got up and I went, right. So soon Monica and I discovered that we wanted bigger, better scooters. And she said, look, my husband belongs to the Ulysses Motorcycle Club down on the coast. Would you like to join? I went, I'm not joining some motorcycle club. Come on. But I soon found a wonderful band of men and women from all walks of life who merely enjoyed riding motorbikes. And what motorbike riding found for me was it was a challenge, like everything in life. I do like to better myself mentally and physically. So off I went, and I learned from some great riders how to ride. But during that time, I also found it helped me mentally through the police force drama, through a poor marriage, a divorce, single parenthood. I cried sometimes, I laughed all on my own, but I had to learn how to stay on that bike, and it distracted me. So I eventually ended up at the Ulysses Motorcycle Group on their committee as the webmaster and the secretary. And I went on some wonderful trips. I've ridden to South Australia, I've ridden to Victoria, Queensland, Tasmania. But I'm now riding a Harley Switchback, an 1800cc, 320-kilo bike. But don't ever forget, you've got to walk before you can run. So it's been a long process, but I still ride with my partner and my friends and girlfriends, and I'm really proud of it, and it is such a freedom. The wind in your hair and the bugs in your teeth, there's nothing like it.
I hadn't thought of the bugs in your teeth. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Oh, dear, that's funny. And tell me about getting involved with the Singing Hands Choir. Oh, that sounds so beautiful. Tell us what that is.
It was beautiful. Once again, I wanted to learn a new skill, and I've always sort of admired people that can do sign language. I think it's another language. And so I went and joined Singing Hands, and it was a group who would sign to a song. So we would sing whilst doing sign language, and it was such a lovely group of people with some incredible skills. And we would often go to a church hall, and we would do a show for hearing impaired people. And from my understanding, when deaf people are at a concert or hearing something, they can only feel the rhythm through the chair or the floor. They can't actually hear the voices. But the minute we started signing and could communicate with them the words of the song along with the beat, they were joyous. They were so joyous. Aww. And the feeling again of giving joy to someone was really rewarding. And I actually learned to sign a little bit, which I have used in different situations, but a really lovely, enjoyable group. Yeah.
Oh, how lovely. God, they're so lucky to have somebody like you. And the last thing, you're a driving instructor with NRMA. With NRMA.
Yes.
Why on earth would a policewoman choose to be in a car with a teenager who's learning to drive? What possessed you?
Noel, do you know how many parents of teenagers say, why would you want to do that? It's because, as yourself, Noel, for 26 years we were in police chases, we were professional drivers. You know, we chased down baddies and did slide skids and all this sort of stuff, which is a bit exciting, isn't it? And so I thought, it's a walk in the park teaching kids to drive. So my son actually had a lovely NRMA instructor, and I spoke to her about doing it. Because I've got a bad neck from my injury, I really can't lift a lot. So I thought, I could do this, and I love it. I just really love imparting safety towards our teenagers, because it's a bit like swimming. If you're not a good swimmer, the consequences are pretty dire. So I really embraced it. I take it very seriously, and the parents like that, and I hope I'm making safer drivers on our roads.
Mm, yeah. Well, look, thank you, Judy, for everything that you have done and you continue to do, but your service to the community, particularly in relation to young drivers. You know, I've interviewed a number of parents of young men who've been involved in fatal car crashes, and with the utmost respect for them, the fewer of those heartbroken parents I speak to, the better. So thank you, Judy. I think we might have to have a part two at some point soon.
That would be lovely, Narelle. I've really enjoyed speaking with you and imparting you the joy I have felt and the pride at being a police officer. And I'll never forget, you're always part of that blue family. Still am, always will be.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks again, Judy.
My pleasure. Thanks, Narelle.
Hey, it's Narelle here again. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcasts as much as we enjoy putting them together. But to make sure you never miss an episode of Narelle Fraser Interviews, hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating and even a review. And please share it with all your friends too. And again, thanks for joining us. We have got some amazing stories to tell. So thanks again. See ya. Hello, guess who? Just a quick interruption here to let you know you can now become a Narelle Fraser Interviews Patreon. How exciting! Simply go to www.patreon, that's P for Peter, A-T-R-E-O-N for Narelle.com, and search for Narelle Fraser Interviews. And to all of you out there who continue to support me, thank you so much.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.